Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi, and with me is the great Armin Navabi. Armin, how are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. And Armin, I think, is going to be very, very excited about this episode. So, Islamic reform. For several years on this podcast, Armin has been talking about the futility of Islamic reform, the flaws with it, and how he thought that it's not going to work. And what's interesting right now is that the people, the main players in the Islamic reform movement, either have audiences that are very sort of generally, I mean, they're not reaching the right people that need to, but a lot of these people just kind of faded out of existence, right? So there have been several recent things, and there was a lot of excitement a few years ago about the Islamic reform movement. Today, it's largely died down. Majid Nawaz, who, by the way, he's a friend and he's a great guy that we both know.
Your friend? He thinks I'm his enemy.
Oh, he does? Okay, I don't know when that happened. But so Majid Nawaz, he founded the Quilliam Foundation. It was very successful for a little while, and that has folded. Just announced that they have essentially folded. They've ended the Quilliam Foundation, so that's not happening anymore. There were prominent figures like Imam Tawhidi. They have faded from the public eye. Then there are other sort of reform-minded people, like Mustafa Akyol and some of these other guys, but they tend to cater to a very Western audience. I mean, a lot of what they're saying is not really resonating with actual Muslim population. On the other hand, the ex-Muslim movement, to Armin's point, for several years, is all over like Arabic YouTube. I mean, there are many, many major players who are influencing and having an impact on and resonating with people in the Muslim world. So what happened to the Islamic reform movement? Like, it had certain goals. Did it achieve them? Was it ever capable of delivering on the big changes that it promised? And why didn't it work? All right. So I think a lot of this is going to come down. Armin, I'd like to discuss this in the context of some of the arguments that you made for several years about this Islamic reform thing. And where they are now. So what are your initial thoughts about this?
Before I get to initial thoughts, because I need to say this at the beginning because people might not listen to the end, is that because we do these live streams when a lot of patrons are not available to come and join live. Oh, actually, I see we already have a question. What we're doing is on Patreon, when we post these live streams, so many people have questions and they can't be here to ask their questions live. So for our patrons, we're letting them on Patreon. When we make a post about the live streams, you could post in the comment section your questions of that specific post for the live stream. And then when we're doing it live, if you're sleeping and if you're not available, I'll make sure to answer your questions. So this is a lot of people have been complaining that we can't answer their questions live, and this is our solution. So if you're a patron, every time we post a live stream on our Patreon account, in the comment section of that post, ask your questions, and we'll make sure to answer them, okay? Here's the thing. Am I going to, come and say, I told you so, and is that fit? Am I going to do that? Am I going to be like, ha-ha, yes, of course I am. How could I not, right? Like, yeah.
You're going to celebrate around the dead bodies of Islamic reform. Like, you're going to do going to dance on the grave. Yeah.
Right. Yes, of course I'm going to. I'm not going to just dance on their grave. I'm going to piss on their grave, right? Like, of course. but, no, there's no but. That's it. I do think there is a misunderstanding about what my views are on this. Right, a lot of people are like, oh, here's proof that Islam can't be reformed. The argument is not that if Islam can't be reformed. There's two things. First of all, Islam definitely can be reformed. Okay. My point is, Islam shouldn't be reformed. Not that it can't be reformed. Islam has been reformed throughout history many, many, many times. And usually there's in two different directions. Okay. Every time that there's a challenge and people are not happy and there's a crisis of identity or a certain Islamic regime or Islamic power as a whole gets reduced or challenged in a certain way, there's some reflection by Muslims and there's some trying to look at where the source of the problem is and how could it be addressed. And this has happened many, many times throughout history, right? This is not something, oh, let's reform, let's look at Islam in a different way. Like, this is not something that Majid Nawaz or Imam Tawhidi have came up with, okay? This has been, from the very beginning, this has been the case, okay? And usually, there is two... Ali, when you're not speaking, can you mute your microphone? Because there's wind blowing in the mic. Usually there's two different responses to that. This is a very simplistic take. I'm just going to categorize it in two different categories. Is it too simplistic? Yes, but you get it's good for the point of this podcast. It's either the source of our problems is that we need to be pragmatic and look at Islam in a way that is more acceptable by the new standards of our time. And we need to look at people who are better than us or superior than us or stronger than us and see if we could look at Islam to make it seem like it suggests also the things that they're suggesting. And again, this is from the very beginning, Islamic philosophers or scholars, they looked at Greek philosophy and they're like, we like some of that, thank you very much. And they looked at the Quran and Hadith, they were like, oh, look, the Quran already said this. Like, they tried to come up with a way to make it seem like Islam is basically speaking to whatever Aristotle or Plato or whatever say, right? So this was one aspect. Another aspect was to be more I don't know what you call it, more literal, more like, maybe no, the source of our problem is that we are doing too much, we're too much influenced by we're being too pragmatic, like we're looking at other sources and influence from other places, and we need to just focus on the Quran and the Hadith and reduce the influence from outsiders. And we could, and the more radical these movements are, the answer is to get more closer and closer to the literal wording of the Quran or the Hadith, right? And again, this was also from the beginning, was always there, right? You had the Mu'tazilites and you had the people who were against them, right? And then you had the Ibn Taymiyyans, and then you had your Ghazalis and you had your Ibn Sinas, and all of these people were either in one camp or another one. And I know there's a lot of differences between them, but loosely they would fit in one camp or another, right? And this was happening for the past, I don't know, 1300 years. And this was just another version of that. The interesting thing about these whole reform things is that what we're saying is we think that Islam is always the problem, right? It's not ever the solution. So even when there is progress towards modernity or being pragmatic, these people who are suggesting reform pretend that the source is Islam, but any form of improvement in society, like even when it comes to people who we celebrate as great thinkers in the Islamic world, like Ibn Sina, or Avicenna, as according to Westerners, you can see that they managed to make a lot of influence and progress because of them being less influenced by Islam and getting their inspiration and their knowledge from other sources, right? And the more that was challenged, somewhat by Ghazali, or more radically by people like Ibn Taymiyyah, that was a source of regress rather than progress. Every time, every time the focus was on sources of information that was less based on science or intelligence, that basically is responsible for the end of the age of the golden age of what other people call the golden age of Islam. I call it the golden age of Persians and Arabs. And, Ibn Taymiyyah is a very destructive source of influence, for example, in Islam, right? And what you also see now, for example, is these modern Western-focused, reform-minded so-called scholars, or like thinkers, they were Imam Tawhidi or Majid Nawaz. They were a very pathetic and weak version of all of that, right? Because at least what the other reformers throughout history, the ones that were trying to push for a more pragmatic way of looking at Islam and trying to Islam is compatible with these newer, more advanced way of thinking, or sometimes even not newer, because at least when it comes to the golden age that we mentioned, they were even going back. They noticed how superior, like even Greek philosophers were to the Islamic way of thinking. So it's not even newer; it's just more pragmatic and more useful. However, they would never come and say that there's a problem with Islam, right? They would just try to convince everybody that Islam doesn't contradict these, right? That Islam maybe already spoke to these ways of thinking, like try to come up with a way to suggest that. However, some of these modern reformers, the reason why they openly admitted that there are problems within Islam itself is because their audience was not even Muslims. Their audience was non-Muslims. Ali, you're muted.
I think that's the main thing. That's, I think, one of the most primary reasons why this movement didn't work. And I think it's something that we talk about throughout, is that a lot of these people, even though their ideas, I mean, in theory, they sounded really good and they sounded really interesting. I was like, okay, well, maybe that's possible. For instance, what Majid did, I always liked what Majid did. I think the things that he was talking about were good. He had the experience. He'd had that history. He was part of Hizb ut-Tahrir and everything. But the problem was that there were two aspects to what he was doing that I just was very skeptical about. The first is that he was trying to do the reinterpretation of scripture. I don't think that's convincing, especially to people familiar with it. It's just not convincing. It's not a good way to go. But the second thing that he was doing was that I think most of the audience that he had, right, were Westerners. They're generally Westerners. They weren't even Muslims in the Western world. I mean, they were just Westerners.
Non-Muslim Westerners.
Non-Muslim Westerners, conservative non-Muslim Westerners, sort of centrist, some liberals as well. But that's why I don't think he ever really got the credibility, and it's unfortunate because some of the ideas that he had were good. He actually was very embracing of the ex-Muslim movement, and he saw that as part of Muslim reform, not Islamic reform, but Muslim reform, that can we reform the Muslim community at large, right? But and he was, I think he was wrong about that.
Yeah. So actually, the what Alex is saying in the live chat, I want to respond to this because it goes, Alex is saying, don't you think that what is referred to as Islam could be reformed away into non-existence or into an Islamic heritage interest group or club and thus into harmlessness. Okay, so here's the thing. This concept of Islamic reform has not been... This is why I say Islam can be reformed. So here's the thing. When most people, when they're talking about Islamic reform, they're not talking about both elements in Islamic reform, okay? They're only talking about, from the two groups that I mentioned, when it comes to Islamic reform, they're only talking about the pragmatic group, not the literal group, right? Because in modern times, the two sides of Islamic reform, one of them is like the people who represent the pragmatic side is like Majid Nawaz or, I don't know, Imam Tawhidi. They have been very unsuccessful. But in modern history, the ones that have been on the reform movements that have been on the side of the literal version have been more successful, right? So the successful modern Islamic reform movement has been Wahhabism, right? So Islam has been successfully reformed in modern times, and it's called Wahhabism, right? Which is, again, a response to, among a few other ones as well, but basically a response to a crisis of identity. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood was born out of that as well. So when the Islamic world is weak and pathetic and compares itself to all these superpowers around the world that is not Islamic, these people's answers was like the answer must be in Islam, right? And they managed to gain a following, and that's what born into some radical movements and some crazy activities here and there. So they have been successful, but the pragmatic side, the reason why they haven't been successful is because they haven't had much for, like, historically, the pragmatic side, we have people that have been very successful, like reform-minded leaders throughout Islamic history that managed to actually gain a following, right? These modern ones haven't been able to, and they haven't been able to gain a following because the because the Islamic world hasn't been able to give any funding, for example, to these people. So they accurately recognize that their support and funding will come from Westerners who have the money, who are afraid of Islam. So basically them trying to chase the money ended up making them not having any Muslim following, which ended up making them completely irrelevant, because people are like, where is your Muslim following? Like, how could you reform Islam when you don't even have a Muslim following, right? But this is a good thing that they didn't have a success, because unlike what Alex, what you're asking, is that traditionally, these pragmatic Islamic reforms are responsible for why Islam is still relevant, right? Islamic reform does not reform Islam into non-existence. It just keeps the... Because here's the thing. As long as you have anything that is called Islam, what you're doing is that you're giving authority and legitimacy just by label. Even not people who are... Because nominal Muslims and reform-minded Muslims are two completely separate things, right? And it's interesting because... Reform leaders try to use nominal Muslims as a way to act like they have the high numbers, but they are not reform-minded Muslims, right? So when I say nominal Muslims, because what people have to understand is that most Muslims, just like most people in the world, don't go through their lives thinking about philosophy, the purpose of life, afterlife, whether their lifestyle matches their worldview. They don't think about these things. Most people don't, okay? And most people just go through their lives. They work. They have a career. They make a living. Even if you're a Muslim, you're either a Muslim. So there's actually two types of... The vast majority of Muslims are either nominal Muslims or minimalist Muslims. Nominal Muslims are people who are just Muslim by name, and they don't do anything that could be considered Islamic throughout their life, unless like somebody dies or somebody's getting married or it's Ramadan. And those are nominal Muslims. Minimalist Muslims are Muslims who do the very few basic things that are supposed to do just to make sure that, like, but it's just like you just do the five prayers a day, or three if you're Shia, and the fast during Ramadan. I don't know, like, just a few things. They have a Quran on the bookshelf. They don't usually pick it up. And these are, when they pray, it's just like brushing your teeth. That's a thing you do in a day, right? If you're a woman, you wear your hijab. It's just a thing you do. You don't really think about it. Even when you're praying, you're doing your prayer, you're actually not thinking about God or stuff. You just like, you do the same thing when you're, you think about the same things you do when you're brushing your teeth. Those are minimalist Muslims. So you have nominal Muslims and you have minimalist Muslims. And these are the majority of Muslims in the world, right? So the fact that these Muslims the vast majority of Muslims are peaceful, and you know, a lot of them want some freedoms and maybe are okay with secularism or whatever, and just have the average views of most other people around them do, and they're just reflecting the view that is based on the community around them rather than anything from Islam. This was there before and during these reformers came along, and the fact that some of these, like Majid Nawaz, for example, tries to claim credit for, oh, look how most Muslims are peaceful, look, Islamic reform is working, as if he had anything to do with that, that's like laughable. Like the fact that you want to count minimalist and nominal Muslims as a way to suggest that Islamic reform is working, that's pathetic and you know, you had no influence on these people, okay? None of your movements had any influence on these people, okay? Muslims are not just like robots that you just like shoving at the Quran in them and just follow it. Beep, beep. You know, they're not, it doesn't work like that, right? They're influenced by many, many different things. So the fact that they're living lives that, you know, the fact that a lot of them are cool with gay people, or a lot of them are, you know, want democracy or peace and stuff, it doesn't mean that Islam advocates that. It means that they're less influenced by Islam because they're human beings, and Islam is so anti-human that most people cannot be followed. Then, like,
yeah.
But let me get to this question, because the question is asking. So the point I'm trying to make is that Islamic reform makes it the people who are anti the values that Islam advocates, like most sane people, right? Would look at Islam and they would want to not have this remain relevant. What Islamic reform does is constantly, every time that Islam is on the decline and it's being pushed away from out of society, what Islamic reform constantly does throughout history is comes and gives hope to people, because a lot of people see reform as a way to make it seem like it's not all that bad. Let's not throw away the baby out with the bathwater. And it gives people a reason to keep that there. And the thing is that you can't reform Islam into non-existence, because just the name Islam is going to be tied into the Quran and the Hadith forever. Like, even if you could get rid of like relevance to the Hadith, the Quran itself is a barbaric, violent, anti-woman, anti-gay, anti, you know, human, anti-science, faith-based document that by just giving authority, just what I'm saying, even nominal, not even reform-minded Muslims, just nominal, minimalist Muslims, just in numbers, gives authority and legitimacy to that book, which at and you giving any credence to this movement, any form of Islamic reform movement, is going to make it so that they remain relevant, and at some point any other form of reform movement, you know, and movement that is more literal is there for the grabbing. Or not just radicals, just governments, average people, people who want to spend legitimize their pseudo intellectual views. Anybody could come and take advantage of these books that are anti-human and anti-science. And that's why Islamic reform will always be dangerous. Ali, you want to say something before I continue?
I agree with all of that. I mean, that's, as long as you have that, then there's always an opportunity. If you keep the whole idea of Islam alive, and if you keep the whole idea and you give it a diluted form, then that becomes a launching ground for later on. The sources are still there. The fundamentals are still there. Anybody at any time in the future can basically take that and go with it and go in the direction that you don't want them to go. So that's one thing to your point. That's right. The other thing is, like, historically, whenever you've had reform movements, it's always been a retrospective thing. When you think of the reform, how did Christianity for instance, become such a diluted hippy-dippy version of what Christianity used to be in the Dark Ages, right? In Christian Europe and Christendom, how did it end up becoming this sort of hippy-dippy version of it that you see in the U.S., separate from the state and, you know, mocked by comedians and TV shows and stuff and all that? How did that happen? It didn't happen because there were people who said, okay, we're going to reform Christianity. And Christianity, it was reformed by people who challenged Christianity, like Thomas Jefferson actually taking a razor blade to the Bible, or someone like Voltaire, actually just challenging the whole notion of religiosity. And these are people who were anti-religion. They weren't religious reformers. They were anti-religion. And people like that, with their work and everything that they did and bringing out biblical criticism and talking about challenging the infallibility of the Christian messiahs and prophets and everything, when they challenged those things, that's when it, now we look back at it retrospectively and we say we have this dilute version of Christianity light that's all about peace and love. That's a result of anti-religionists. It's not a result of people who...
Okay, you mentioned that three times. Can I respond to that?
Yes, go ahead, respond to it. What do you want to say?
All right, no, Christianity was not reformed for a better in any shape or form, okay?
No, I'm not saying...
Ali, I try to not interrupt you so I can...
But you've been talking a lot. I'm saying that Christianity... I didn't say Christianity was reformed for the better. Nobody's saying it was reformed for the better. I said there's a diluted...
Let me know when I can speak.
Okay. You've been speaking for a very, very long time.
That's
okay?
Why I'm saying let me know.
Okay,
when
just
I
a second. The audience loves this. Okay, I'm not saying that it was reformed for the better. I'm saying that it was diluted and it was castrated compared to the way that it was when it was theocratic. That's all. Go ahead, speak.
All right, can I say something without...
I just said go ahead, speak.
No, without interruption for a while, for just a bit.
I'm okay? Not going to interrupt you.
Oh, my God. Just say yes. All right. So Christianity was not reformed at all for the better. Christianity was always and will always remain a barbaric, backward, anti-human, anti-science, anti-anything that is worth preserving religion. Okay. And it's very interesting because people like Ayan Hirsi Ali keep on suggesting like, oh, Islam can be reformed like Christianity, blah, 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 which is nonsense. Nonsense, okay? So what did change from the better, as Ali mentioned, was Christians, okay? Christians were reformed. Christianity, again, I'm not saying Christianity is not reformed. Christianity constantly reforms. Judaism constantly reforms. Islam constantly reforms. But they don't reform for a better. If they do try to, in fact, I've considered a pragmatic reform of these religions more dangerous than the literal reform. So as I mentioned, there's two different reforms that these religions constantly go from. One literal, one more literal, one more pragmatic. The pragmatic ones are more dangerous than the literal ones. The literal ones just like expose how dangerous these religions could be. The pragmatic ones are the ones that keep these dangerous ideologies linger with society longer. Right. What the positive influence that we had in the Christian world was the fact that, as Ali mentioned, not from the people who came out and tried to reinterpret like the Bible. No, it was from the Voltaires of the world that came and challenged Christianity. So it wasn't from within, it was from outside. Like, first of all, even the people that come from within and they're like, hey, let's look at this scripture and be more pragmatic about it and see if we could be a little bit more, do some gymnastic arguments and make it mean something that they don't actually mean. They don't come, that movement from within Christianity or within Islam doesn't happen voluntarily from the Christians and Muslims themselves. Because when your religion is winning and is giving you source of influence, people don't come and say like, hey, let's give up power willy-nilly without any source of pressure, right? That is usually the pragmatic reform movements that always come is a response to an outside pressure coming from outside of the religion, right? That's a response to the Voltaires in the world, right? And that's why if you're one of those idiots who think Islamic reform is a good thing, movements, pragmatic ones is a good movement, you have to understand that people who are fighting against Islam and also economic progress. Those are the source, the drivers behind this defense mechanism. This is a Islamic, the pragmatic Islamic movements are a defense mechanism against outside pressure, against either people who, there's two versions of ideas. Either ideas that are actively challenging the religion, or ideas that are not actively challenging the religion, they're just coming about and they're just better. They're not even trying to defeat the religion, they're just better, and they're just getting so many followers, right? So it's a response to that. So even if you want these, I don't want them, but even if you want these reform movements to happen more often, then become a patron for secular jihadists, because we are this, we represent the Voltaires of our, we are on the side of the Voltaires of our time, not, you know, not the Ghazalis of our time. So the pressure comes from outside. And the reason why you're like, oh, well, great. So we will challenge Islam and hopefully we get the pragmatic reform movements growing. No, not hopefully, because again, that's a defense against mechanism against us. That is we're trying to make Islam irrelevant, less relevant. That pragmatic reform movement is a response to us as a way to keep its relevancy. We don't want Islam to remain relevant, right? So yes, it is a natural reaction to competition against religion, but it's not a good thing. If that wasn't there, these religions will become less influential faster. Ali, do you want to say? I have a lot more to say, but
I actually wanted to move in, like, in the second half of this. I wanted to talk about some of the people who were. But do you have anything to say before we move on to?
I have a lot more to say, but I want to give you a chance to keep talking.
Well, I mean, there was you have the arguments with the reform. I'll say one more thing, and this is something that both of us have talked about here. Is the problem with a lot of the stuff when you're talking about Islamic reform and Muslim reform, when you give people another version of the same thing, but that thing is false. Okay, you're giving them, say, a lighter version of it, and you think, well, it's probably harmless. It's like saying, well, you know, astrology is harmless. It's just something that people believe in for fun. But the problem is that it does not, it still reinforces the process, an anti-critical thinking process. Okay, so when you say that, the Islam is still real, the Quran is still the word of God, but it doesn't, all these violent things, they don't really mean what they're supposed to mean. If they're taken out of context, we can reinterpret them. The problem is that doesn't challenge the whole, the notion that you need to critically think and look for evidence. And when you don't do that, you have that same, that quote from, again, Voltaire. No, it wasn't Voltaire. Who was it? I think it was Voltaire. The person... The people who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. So it doesn't matter if those absurdities are diluted. It doesn't matter if those absurdities are harmless or they're more fun or they're more spiritual, whatever it is. If they are absurdities, if they are false, right? People who can make you believe that can still make you commit atrocities. All they are is just waiting for the right time for a demagogue to come in, reinterpret it the other way, and still get you to do terrible things. Why? Because the process of critical thinking, the process of the scientific method and following evidence before believing in something, that's not in place. So that's one of the fundamental problems with all religion that reform does not correct. In fact, it unfortunately reinforces that bad habit. It reinforces a bad process to get to information. Right? That's the one thing I'd say. I think we've covered it here before, but... that's the one thing I would say to add to this. But if you have anything else to say, with the argument, we can do that. But I do want to talk about some of the founders or some of the people who were active in this reform movement and what happened to them and why there was a downfall of the whole thing.
Right. Okay. I have two things to say, and I also want to respond to some things Alex and Mars are saying in the live chat. First of all, I do want to mention that when I and Hirsi Ali keep suggesting that, the Protestant Reformation movement, that is what we need for Islam, that is absolutely insane, because the Protestant Reformation movement, first of all, did not improve anything. Well, maybe some. Okay. So there's a but to that. But here's the thing. The Protestant Reformation movement, the version of that in Islam is the Wahhabi movement, okay? So the Protestant Reformation movement did not make anything more liberal or more. In fact, it did the opposite, right? It made everything. It was more anti-Jewish. It was more anti-woman. It was more anti-bid'ah, basically, and focus on the text of the Bible, right? Is that what you want with Islam? You want the version of Islam that is more focusing on the literal meaning of the Quran and less innovation? Because that was what the Reformation was asking for, okay? And that is exactly what Wahhabism in Islam is. So yeah, Christian reformations, you want that form of reform in Islam? We already have that, and it was successful, and it's called Wahhabism, okay? So to be fair to the Reformation movement, the only plus that whole movement had for damaging maybe Christianity eventually was not because the Reformation movement itself was a damage or to Christianity or it liberalized it in any way. It's only because that whole process kind of popularized the idea of protesting and standing up to authority, to any form of authority. And that might have, to some extent, be part of what eventually led to, Enlightenment movement and more people challenging authority. But that was just very indirect, okay? I'm just being honest here when it comes to credit. But the real damage, the real challenge against Christianity and eventual reform of Christians for the better, not the reform of Christianity for better, was the Enlightenment movement, which is exactly why the name of this podcast is for them, it has Enlightenment in it. We want the Enlightenment movement copy of that for the Islamic world. We don't want to copy the Reformation movement for the Islamic world. We want a copy of the Enlightenment movement. Unlike what Ayan Hirsi Ali wants for the Muslim world, we don't want the Reformation movement for the Muslim world. We want the Enlightenment movement for the Muslim world. So that's that. Another thing I want to mention is that here's the thing. I think we have found a solution. We have completely analyzed and zoomed in on exactly what the missing element here is and what exactly people want and cling to that make some of these pragmatic reform movements, like not these modern ones because they were pathetic and weak, but the earlier ones, why they work sometimes, even in the face of like obvious damage that Islam or Christianity has for society. Why do people want this, and how we could give them those things without actually promoting something so destructive like religion, right? So This is very important for people to understand, because people confuse these two with each other. And I think we have labeled them pretty accurately. I don't think there was labeling for this before. But instead of reforming Islam, I think what we are now saying, this is the phrase we use, we want to secularize Islam, all right? And it's a lot of people think like it's they get confused and they think like these are the same thing, but they're the exact opposite of each other, right? So when it comes to reforming Islam, the thing that Islamic reform preaches, the pragmatic version, I know a lot of people say, just when they hear Islamic reform, they only think about the pragmatic direction, not the radical one. The thing that it pretends that it's trying to do is to get rid of the harmful parts of Islam and yet keep Islam. Okay, we're against that because we don't want to keep the belief. The problem with Islam, just like the problem with Christianity or religion as a whole, is the core. The foundation is the fact that it's based on faith. It's based on superstition. It's based on believing in things that we have no evidence for. These are just the natural product. Like when you believe in nonsense, the natural product of it is coming up with conclusions that are destructive to society, right? So there is corrupted to the very core. And what the Islamic reform movement is trying to do is like keep the core, but just come and cut like some poisonous fruits out. Like, oh, let's just cut this fruit out. Let's cut this fruit out. Maybe we could keep the core. But no, when the core is rotten, it will constantly produce problematic results in different ways, right?
Right.
so the secularization of Islam, or just like secularization of the other religion, is basically keeping some of the fruits that are just, you know, tradition, dance, art, and just cutting, like removing the core, nuking the core, right? Yeah. And just keeping the small little things that people enjoy, right? We think that we should let mythology, dance, calligraphy, community, even when it comes to the with the religious symbolism, but get rid of the belief, right? Get beloved of the faith, and not only think we should encourage people to enjoy the tradition, but we show them that it's actually, the tradition is actually even more fun without the belief.
Right? I love what you said about the tree analogy, like the fact that you have the roots, right? If you leave the roots intact and you just trim away like the poisonous fruits, the roots are still intact. That's what reform is. But what we're talking about is taking some of the roots and picking them and enjoying the fruit of the tree, but destroying the rest of the tree. And that's what we do. Right. I think that contrast is fantastic. That's exactly, if you want to sum, we've been talking about this for years, but I think that analogy really, really sums up everything that we're saying about, you know, keeping the cultural elements and the bells and whistles and having fun with those, but just getting rid of the belief, getting rid of the roots and the rotten core. Whereas what they want to do, the reform people want to do, is they're like, no, we got to keep the roots intact, because we take out the roots that upset a lot of people. So let's just cut a few twigs and branches off. Like that's not going to work. And it hasn't worked. And it is, we're doing the autopsy right now.
And the reason why this methodology works, Ali, is because because a lot of people don't listen. Most people are not busy listening to podcasts or reading books, right? So the beautiful thing about this method is that you could do this by showing people and entertaining them rather than convincing them, right? So what we could do is that we could actually take part and actively start celebrating Islamic mythology and art and architecture while openly, announcing our disbelief or even hatred for the Islam, if it's true. Like, so we can say, like, look, we can enjoy Egyptian mythology without believing in Egyptian gods, right? So why can't we do that with Islam? So we could, it's a love-hate relationship that we have with Islam. Like, you're like, oh, look, we hate Islam if you actually believe that this is real, and if you actually use it as a guide to life, we hate that. But we also love Islam if you look at it as a part of history and as just an ancient text with a lot of enigma and puzzles that you need to solve. And if you look at, you know, there's some fascination with, architecture and where these ideas came from. Oh, this seems like it came from Jewish people. Oh, this seems like it came from Greek, some Greek thought. Oh, look, this seemed like it came from Christianity. Oh, look how Islam changed from this era to this era, from the Umayyad to the Abbasid. How did it change? Why did it change? What was the politics behind that? There's so much. And this is like, by the way, when you secularize religion in that way, it actually starts finding ways, because you unshackle it from the doctrine itself, it finds a way to become a lot more fun. For a long time, I thought that Islamic celebrations are not as fun as Jewish and Christian ones, because Islam just inherently is not fun. But then I thought, like, no, it's just the process of secularization of Christianity and Judaism has progressed much more, that like Christmas is a lot more fun because it just has gone through that process a lot more. And I think, like, I don't know, Islamic traditions, maybe after many years of going through that secularization process, could end up being, you know, find a way to market it. If there's a demand for it, there's going to be, you know, it's going to progress and evolve in a way that it's going to be a lot more fun in the future, I think. Yeah.
So let me just make that clear, what you said to people who don't fully get it, is that Christmas and Easter are now, so Christmas is associated with Santa Claus and elves and Christmas trees and everything like that. I mean, there's no Christmas trees or snow or snowflakes where Christmas originated, supposedly. So these things have been added to it. It's become more marketable, right? Santa Claus, Coca-Cola, all of that. Then you have, you know, Easter, you've got bunnies and eggs, and that has nothing to do with the resurrection or what actually happened on Easter. So, and the Islamic sort of, I mean, I don't want to use the term reform. There hasn't been an evolution or a commercialization of Eid, for instance, where we have like an Eid unicorn who comes and gives money to all the little kids or something like that. We haven't had any of those fairy tale and fun elements of it. So it hasn't, and that's the reason that people think that it's not as much fun, but it could be. You just need a good a marketing campaign, and it could be. And that's why it's not a level playing field, but it absolutely could be. You could take those bells and whistles and you could make it fun. And I think that that's something we talked about, that that's something that we should do. Like, we should initiate and bring it about, because that will be, once you secularize the rituals, then the ideology starts fading out. It's very anti ideology. It brings the community thing to the forefront, and ideology it puts to the background. So it's just one method of many. And eat a corn.
Susanna is saying eat a corn.
Yeah. I like it. And eat a corn.
By the way, that's partly why we're doing the Blasphemous Art Project, is to show that we as atheists can enjoy religion without believing in it, right? I do want to highlight some comments from the live chat. Is that a good time, or do you want to say something?
Let's do it. I want to ask you. There's two things that Khalil Andani, he's done his PhD in Islamic studies from Harvard. So he brought up something on Twitter. He's saying, why aren't you interviewing real reformists like Mustafa Akyol or the Usuli Institute? And there's this other one, in she's a professor in New York, I think, at Fordham, Sarah El Tantawi, right? So, and these are sort of serious scholarly reformers who want to do it. And the thing is, you know, I'd actually love to interview them. I'd love to have Mufti Abu Layth, for example. I mean, he's another one he's suggested to come on, and I've actually asked him to, so hopefully it'll happen
soon. No, the main reformer of our time right now is Yasser Qadhi.
Yasser Qadhi is a man. But he's
the one with the most success, and it, because he's from the traditionalist, now changing his opinion on things. Like, he comes from them. Mufti Abu Layth is too
fringe.
Is too fringe, and his suggestions are too crazy to be taken seriously by traditional. Like, the people who follow him are people who are already nominal or minimalist. Yeah, and he's suggesting some crazy. No Islamic school of thought, no mainstream Islamic school of thought would, and I think rightly so, would not take him ever seriously ever. But yeah.
And the response to Khalil here is that that Mustafa Akyol and all these guys, and they're very smart guys. They come up with really good ideas. You know, the Usuli Institute, whatever they're trying to do. The thing is, they're not taken seriously by people who aren't already with them. The tiny little sliver of people who are already with them, like Mufti Abu Layth, they're the only ones who take them seriously. They're not rocking the boat where they need to be rocking the boat. Even if they try to, they don't. And they largely have Western audiences, and they're working over here in the West. It's just not something that's impactful. In fact, Imam Tawhidi probably has more of an impact than some of these people do.
Imam Tawhidi. Okay, here's the thing. Imam Tawhidi and these scholars that you mentioned, and also Majid Nawaz, they're not going to make much of a difference. Another person, like I mentioned, Yasser Qadhi is the best, their best hope. Another person that could be considered relevant is Shabir Ali, Dr. Shabir Ali. These are, you know, because they don't look like reformists. When you look at Majid Nawaz, and when you look at Mufti Abu Layth, you look at them and you think bid'ah. You're like, oh my God, these people are here to innovate Islam out of being Islam as a whole. And that's why they don't even have a chance. But when you look at Dr. Shabir Ali, or even you tell Yasser Qadhi, you think like, oh, these people look and sound and have the history of being a traditionalist. So when they are trying to reform Islam, they are like sneaking in some things that it just like, I'm actually going to review some of their videos for everybody to see, because they sneak, they try to, they are so much more clever than people like Medina was. They are trying to sneak in reform in a ways that most Muslims do not even, they think that they're listening to, like, they consider these people like traditionalist Muslims, and they're like trying to sneak in reform through the back door. It's right. very clever, and I hope they fail, because they have a lot more chance than anything.
And like, I should add, like, to that is Mubin Sheikh, who's the, you know, former, like, he's the guy who ceases with Canadian intelligence, went underground to the Toronto 18 and foiled that plot. So this guy, he actually responded to Khalil, and he said, and I agree with him here. He said, he's saying what you're saying, is Nawaz and Tawhidi don't have the scholarly credentials required to deliver, sort of, because their funders and their promoters were hostile to Islam at large. That did not do them any favors. It's better to interview those who are trained in usul al-fiqh, because reform is achieved on traditional terms, right? And that's what Shabir Ali and these people are doing. You've got the traditional terms, and Yasir Qadhi, they've got the tradition, and they will add in some of these reform elements. Last thing before we go into, I'm going to suspend like not more than 2 or 3 minutes on this. Some of the big people in this movement, okay, the Muslim movement, if you go to the website, muslimreformmovement.org, a lot of them are actually on this website. So I'll just kind of name some of the members, and we can sort of go with some of the more prominent members. So there was Tariq Fatah, Asra Nomani, right? We know about those Maz and Nawaz. These people, I mean, they're so, Asra Nomani pretty much like died right when she wrote that op-ed about why I voted for Trump. And you know, that essentially, you know, her
movement died.
Yeah, her entire movement died. Like,
Ali, can you say this quick? Because I really have a lot of questions that I need to answer.
There is. So a lot of them kind of went and they aligned themselves with the people who were saying we should ban Muslims and things like that. You know, Ayan Hirsi Ali kind of fell into that trap too. So did Tariq Fatah, went all the Hindutva sympathizer, and he became, you know, just came across very overtly hypocritical. And, you know, recently, I think Majid Nawaz was one of the last people standing, but then recently with all the stuff that he had about, you know, the election fraud and how he got into that whole conspiracy bandwagon.
Ali, don't say that. That's a very sensitive YouTube thing to say. Do not ever, do not mention that whole thing, that whole conspiracy.
So anyway, everybody knows what I'm talking about. So he got on that train, and then that kind of deleted. So a lot of these people, they've died out even for reasons that are not even related to what they were trying to do. Right. And they just kind of made very, very bad PR decisions. Bad PR decisions. They didn't really have the vision to extend it. They could have just stuck to what they were doing and focusing on that instead of trying to focus on the people who were trying to help them and support them and really sort of kowtow to them. And they chose, they made the wrong decision. So let's go to patron questions.
Okay. So Alex, I take your point about the name Islam, but what you're discussing is whether you're publicly in favor of reform, i.e. whether you use the term reform, but couldn't literal Islam... No, we're not at all talking about what you're publicly saying, Alex. We're not talking about what labels to use. If you're trying to reform Islam, even if you don't call it reform Islam, that's dangerous. That is a very harmful movement. It's not about the labeling. It's not about what you call it. Just the idea of trying to preserve Islam while trying to modernize it or change it pragmatically in any way to try to make it the founding text mean something else to adjust to the time that you're in. That whole process, whether you call it reform or not, is what keeps Islam relevant. And it's not, it's a very destructive movement.
Yeah. And again, can I address that too? Like, there's just really quickly, in my book, use the term reform to talk about the way to get from there to complete, you know, basically irreligiosity. And I used that path, and I would have written it differently now. Right. But I completely agree that I think that, you know, it's not that, it's not about whether you use the term reform.
Yeah. I think in the second comment, you're saying the same thing, Alex, saying the same applies to literal Christianity. Don't call it reform publicly, but the idea is to whittle away tenet by tenet and practice by practice until literal. So again, it's not, so you missed our point, Alex. It's not about what you call it. We are that whole process that you're talking about, it doesn't work. That's actually the process that you're describing is exactly what is the process used not to make it completely go away. That's a process that is used to keep Christianity relevant and keep it going.
Yeah. The thing that actually does that actually gets it away tenet by tenet and practice by practice, is when you attack the whole thing. You attack it. The people who have been the most vociferous and aggressive attackers of Christian doctrine, they have been able to achieve this. The effect has been to whittle it away tenet by tenet because of that action, not because actually literally whittling away tenet by tenet.
It never happens from within. It comes never from happens. Attacking it from outside. Mm-hmm. Mars is saying,
does Rahil Razag still go along with the idea of reform? Where does she currently stand on the issue, especially since Quilliam was founded, folded? The last time I met her was, I think, a little over a year ago. I think there was an event for a blasphemy. She's absolutely lovely. I absolutely love her. She's amazing. But yes, she still goes along with the idea of reform. I've talked to her personally, and she does believe so. It is authentic, but she just wants to change the way it's done. She has a very sort of spiritual interpretation of the Quran. But again, I don't think that that's effective. She's extremely articulate. I don't know. Clearly, it's not something that's effective. She's part of the
spiritual interpretation, lovey-dovey spiritual, non-Wahhabi, non-radical interpretation of Islam are the most dangerous parts of it. I have to remind everybody that it was the Sufis that people like Ghazali who are responsible for the radicalization and the complete destruction of the so-called the golden age of so-called Islam. Again, that's a really bad term for it. The golden age of Arabs and Persians was destroyed by Sufi spiritual movements like Ghazali, not even by the traditionalists or by the literalists. So these movements are destructive and they need to go away, and we will be here to fight them. Okay, Jim
is saying, how do you remove the core and give people a sense of community and sense of tradition and sense of purpose and meaning? If the core is removed, it is easy to then get groups to form around victimhood. So I see why you would in theory think that, but this has been done. I mean, if you look at with Judaism, with secular Jews, I mean, you have secular Jews, and most Jews happen to be secular. They have the holidays, they have the bells and whistles. You know, they keep traditions, some of them not great, like circumcision and stuff, but they do all of that stuff. But very few of them actually take Judaism seriously. Like, nobody sits down and says, I'm not going to eat bacon, I'm not going to eat shellfish. They sit down, they have lobster, they have all kinds of things, but there's a sense of community. They reformed. You know, with not one word, they reformed their whole thing as a community, and not they came together as a sense of community instead of ideology, and which is why you can leave Judaism and still be accepted in the community. So
let me answer as well, Jim. So Jim is saying, how do you remove the core and give people a sense of community? I mean, I don't know how else we can prove that this has been done, given that so many atheists still celebrate Christianity. And in Judaism, this whole process of secularization has happened so much that even we have even rabbis that call, they say they don't believe in God. Like, they're just doing all the motions. They just go to, you know, they just do this Jewish celebrations, they eat the Jewish food, they sing the Jewish religious thoughts. And yeah, many of them, you ask them, like, hey, do you believe in these stories? Like, they're like, no, we don't think it happened, but they still do all those things. Like, we know that, like, in Norway, a lot of people come out on Sunday, they come out of the church, you ask them, they believe in God, a lot of them say no, and they still go to church on Sundays. Right. So the fact that this can be done is like undisputed. Like, again, guys, if you get rid of the belief, then anything that you keep with the tradition or this, you know, with the art or whatever, or the community, it cannot be harmful. Because the only way you could do harmful things in the name of religion is if you actually believe that this is actually God wants you to do them. If you don't actually believe that these are real things, you're only going to do the things that you think is fun and that gives you some sense of community or whatever. There's no way that you're going to go like do something crazy in the name of something that you don't even believe that is a legit real thing, right? Mm-hmm. So, and it has been done, and we think Islam needs to go through the secularization process, not through the reform process.
Okay. So 2 more minutes. What are so this is maybe the last question, actually, isn't it?
No, we have one more question on Patreon. Somebody asked, like, three comments.
Three, okay, Fawad is asking, what are your thoughts on progressive Islam movements?
We did this whole thing was about that.
About that, this is a reformist.
We spoke Islam. About this, we just said again, it doesn't matter what you call it, if you call it reform, if you call it progressive Islam movement, it's the same thing that we spoke about it for one
and
hour.
I gotta say, we'll work with them, we've worked with them on certain things, like if you're talking about spreading secularism and they're on it, and we're on it, you know, we'll work with them on a practical level, but it's not the same.
Ali, that's a very, very good point, because a lot of people are like, oh, these people, why wouldn't you work with them? We have worked with them. Let me just say this.
Yeah, go ahead.
We will never work with them when it comes to reforming Islam. We will work with them on anything else. Not only we will work with them, I will work with traditionalist conservative Muslims on the things we agree in. Just because I'm fundamentally against this whole reform process, that doesn't mean we don't agree on other things. Like, we agree with them on secularism, women rights, gay rights, but whenever they want to push the idea of Islamic reform, we will stand against that aggressively. But whenever they like, hey, let's promote secularism, yeah, sure, why not? But again, they don't have to be reformist Muslims for me to work with them. If you're a traditionalist conservative Muslim and you want to speak against China, against the way that they're treating Muslims in China, I will work with you even though you're a traditionalist conservative Muslim. So if I work with them, why wouldn't I work? I would work with any Muslim on the things that we agree with. This one is many would call the outside influence reform, dismantling it aggressively from the outside. Again, it doesn't really matter what you call it. You know what we mean by reform. What you call it is completely irrelevant, Alex. We are just using labels to tell you what we are for and what we're against. The outside pressure, if you want to call it a reform, fine. I don't care. We're for that. The outside attack on Islam, whatever you call it, we are for that. The inward trying to doing gymnastic arguments to try to make Islam represent something more modern, we're against that. You want to call that, you want to switch labels on these? Doesn't really matter. We're against that movement and for this other movement.
Yeah, Alex, just for the record, Majid Nawaz does include the ex-Muslim movement as part of the Muslim reform movement. He's like, his whole idea is that, you know, Muslim reform means that ex-Muslims and atheists and everything should be able to speak.
It really doesn't matter. Here's an interesting thing. Every time we disagree with somebody on something and we are actively pushing against it, people are like, oh, but this person agrees with you on this. Like, yeah, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about, like, yeah, imagine about this for secularism, and so are we. Okay, so we agree on that. We're not talking about that here. We're talking about the fact that he's pushing for Islamic reform, and I think that is a very dangerous thing, and I'm glad that that their organization died away. So I'm really happy that they failed. Last question that was posted. Again, this is a reminder to everybody that can't join us live. We're now doing something new. People who ask their questions on Patreon, even if you're not here with us live, when we make a post about the upcoming live stream, if you ask your questions in the comment section, we will read your question and we will answer them live. So you don't actually need to, so all Patreon answers will be answered even if you're not here with us live. Dali is saying, I have a question. Why many Muslims refusing gay rights and accusing anyone of criticizing Islam being Islamophobic? Okay, so I actually disagree with this question. Ali, you answer this.
Highlight it? Did you highlight it?
Well, no, because it's on Patreon. I'm not going to.
Oh, okay. Can you repeat the question, please?
Dali is saying, why many Muslims refusing gay rights and accusing anyone of criticizing Islam being Islamophobic? I mean, we have answered this. This is not really relevant to what we're talking about today, Dali, if you're listening to this later. But, I mean, why do you think it's because of Islam? So why many Muslims refuse gay rights? Well, because I can answer this a little bit better, more interesting. It is because of Islam, but it's not direct. Most Muslims have not read the Quran. Most Muslims, and the vast majority of Muslims, have never even touched the Hadith. Most of these teachings come from Islam. So how could I at one point say these ideas, Muslims are anti-gay because of Islam, and also say Muslims have not read the Quran and Hadith? Well, because the influence on Islam, on Muslims, are indirect, okay? Dali is right. Dali didn't say most. He said many. The numbers could be again, it really depends on where you look, what country you look. It doesn't really matter. Many Muslims are, that influenced by destructive teachings in Islam in an indirect way. So Islam has an influence on the culture and on the preachers, and the preachers have some influence on, you know, the, some indirect influence on the entertainment, on movies, on the songs, on the schooling. And then that's how Muslims usually get exposed to these ideas, not because they actually went and read the hadith and the Quran, and they're following it word by word. And it is by this same reason why when you reform Muslims, again, not Muslim, not reform Islam, when you reform Muslims, it doesn't always have to mean that the win for us is for them to become ex-Muslim. A Muslim can be reformed even if they still technically a Muslim, because what we have managed to successfully do is to reduce the influence of Islam on their life and increase the influence of other sources of information and behavior. Muslims, just like many people, are influenced by many things, by the podcasts they listen to, by the books they read, by their parents, by their friends, by their entertainment. Islam is just many of those things. And as if you could reduce the influence of Islam and increase the source of superior ideas from Islam, even if they're not ex-Muslims, that's progress. Okay, so a lot of people think, like I think, like there's no progress unless you're an ex-Muslim. No, when you fight Islam, you're winning Muslims over by reducing the influence of Islam, not just by people who completely renounce Islam. Okay, that's a win. That's a win. But it's always, Islam is never a source of good behavior or good source of influence of people unless it's being used for entertainment. But when it comes to a guide to life, Islam is never the way. Islam is always bad. Fight Islam. Fight religion. Fight faith. Fight God.
Okay. Yeah. Well said. We're gonna wrap up now. We're a little bit over, but thanks everybody for listening. If you like what you heard here, if you enjoy these shows, then consider becoming a patron. Patreon.com/SJME. You can become a patron for as little as $1 a month. You get 5 episodes. You get to watch live. You get to participate, and even questions that you submit beforehand, as Armin said, will be answered. So you can actually participate. And as you can see here, the patrons actually do drive a significant part of the show whenever we talk about this. So you can do that. If you're watching this on YouTube, please hit the subscribe button, hit the bell so you get notifications. And otherwise, you know, if you like what you hear, share it, go to iTunes, give us a rating. And
yes.
Yeah. Yes. And we're good, everyone.
We're good. All right, guys.
Thank you for joining us. RIP, Muslim Reform Movement.
Yes,
that's terrible. This is your autopsy episode. I feel like there are going to be more of these.
New ones are coming, and I hope they become as irrelevant as these Majidna ones and Imam Tohidi ones. But unfortunately, I think they're going to have a better chance. But we're going to be here to fight them as much as we can.
Anyways, okay, can I say one last thing? Armin did an interview, an extended interview with Imam Tohidi. Go out and watch that. I've actually been, I was on a TV show, the Steve Paikin Show, The Agenda in Canada with Shabir Ali. So make sure you watch that too. That was actually fun. So maybe I'll post the links here under YouTube for those two things. Okay, guys. Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Be best, no?
Be best. Hashtag yes. Be best. Be best.
Right. The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends. Write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions. Or head over to secularjihadist.com and give $1 or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.